Okay, yes, so you were not near the accident. I'm very glad to hear that. Were you anywhere near the accident? Were you near it? Were you in the vicinity? Were you...
Well, I mean, I was at the W Hotel around midnight, which is when it says that this happened, so I guess I was to some degree, but I had no awareness of anything until this morning when, you know, various people reached out about it, so it's pretty bizarre to hear that that went down so close behind.
Are you staying at the W?
No, I'm not. I'm staying outside the downtown area right now. So.
Okay.
So you
were at a party or something? What were you doing at midnight at the W Hotel?
There's a concert venue there, and I went to see Kendrick Lamar. There's a Apple showcase there, So
now this is
Film the Music now.
Now we are talking, of course, on Thursday, and the movie part of SWSW is over, right? At this point.
Well, you know, technically the film festival continues to the second weekend, but they did the awards ceremony on Tuesday, since that's kind of the point when it peaks and a lot of the out-of-towners from the film side leave. It's also when the interactive stuff changes, and there's this whole shift just in terms of the crowds from techies and film people to the music people, the music stuff. So music stuff really dominates now. You can see it in the streets. It's just a completely different kind of dynamic. The film screens continue. So it's kind of interesting. I mean, if you hang out till the very end, you can still pick through the lineup and catch up on a couple of things. So doing a little bit of that now. But for the most part, I kind of crammed it all into that first weekend.
So how much rain was there during the film portion of SWSW?
Oh, my God. It was brutal. I mean, all the locals said they really needed it. So, you know. I mean, I'm from Seattle originally, so I don't get as upset about a little bit of wet weather the way that some people do, but it did kind of put a damper on the nature of the environment, which, you know,
how did it
part of kind of wandering around.
How did the rain in South by Southwest compare to last May's Cannes Film Festival rain? I thought it was amazing. That was almost like 80% rain last year? That was amazing.
That was brutal. This was not nearly that extreme. I mean, it was just kind of basic showers, you know.
Yeah.
The funny thing about it was seeing all the pedicabs doing such amazing business because, you know, they had covers. And so, you know, pedicabs will usually charge you $15 a person, something like that. But I think they were just hiking prices left and right because people were just desperate, you know. So they really won the day there. And then I saw that Uber's prices were jacked up by like 3 times or something. But, you know, I don't think it really hurt the movies. You know, all the venues are in the same place and people are kind of out and about anyway. So it's not like the sort of thing where people are just like, screw it, I'm going to stay home because it's mostly an out-of-town audience anyway.
I took two pedicabs. I've been into South by Southwest once. That was 2 years ago. And I took two pedicabs. And I honestly, I don't know what it is, but I just felt so sorry for the guy on the bike pulling me along. And, you know, Austin is not completely flat. It does have hills. And I was feeling really like, this is rough, man. I mean, you know, you're struggling along and pumping. I know that they're in good shape, and it's a good job to have if you want to get in shape. But still, I just couldn't do it. I mean, I just felt really badly for the guy. I'd rather walk and hump it out myself.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it makes them feel alive, you know.
Yeah.
You have to work your body out and get paid for it. And there's not many other professions that do that, you know. You can be a bartender.
Right.
A little more exciting in some ways, I guess.
Okay, so the absolute, let's just start. We'll talk about your personal favorite and then go to what you think is probably going to have the biggest impact of the one film that you saw at South by Southwest. Your personal favorite was what so far? Or I guess for the
I would say the absolute best narrative at the festival was a movie called Buzzard. It's directed by this guy named Joel Petraicus.
Okay.
And he made one other film before called Ape that not a lot of people saw, about this goofy stand-up comedian. Buzzard stars the same actor. He's a young guy who has kind of like an early Buster Keaton-esque sort of deadpan expression.
Yeah.
And it's an office space type workplace comedy that gradually becomes more and more of this subjective satire of a guy losing his mind. And he's got this unhealthy fixation on Freddy Krueger in the second half of the that he's running around with this homemade Freddy Krueger glove and stealing money from people and just sort of, trying to give a middle finger to capitalism because he's bad by this bureaucratic system that he worked in. He worked at a bank and he goes away from the bank and ends up spending it on all these luxurious things in the final act. And it's really wild and fun and liberating. And also kind of scary because of, what it's saying about sort of the way the workplace culture can drive someone insane. It's also playing at New Directors, New Films in New York next month, so I have a feeling that it's the kind of movie that could really sort of start to accrue a little bit of kind of cult support from people who are into that kind of sensibility. I got echoes of Bellflower, that movie from a couple of years ago, in terms of the kind of masculine extreme of the
feeling,
the way it's ending them up.
Okay. That's right. It played at New Directors, New Films on March 6th, and it played under the Visions division of South by Southwest.
And, right. Which is usually where most of the interesting stuff is.
Yeah. Looks kind of funny. Let me see. How could... Well, I guess almost 70-80% of the interesting independent stuff that's going to be available as a VOD at one point. Did you hear anything about, Oslo's Lope? Okay, they have it. So that means it'll be out sometime?
It's getting up there.
Sometime this
year. I have a feeling that most of the stuff, in an environment like this of quality, is going to find some sort of outlet.
Right.
The truth is it's not really an industry-oriented festival.
Yeah.
So movies that, might have some kind of future, that they're going to screen around a little bit more.
Uh-huh.
For the most part, there's very few that I think, because of their South by premiere, they're just going to land a distribution deal overnight. I mean, the biggest deal that ever came out of this festival was Monsters, that Gareth Edwards film, the guy who's doing the new Godzilla film, was, I think, picked up for like $1 million or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And that was bought by Tom Quinn, and he was like the only distributor there, so there was no bidding war or anything like that. And they don't have press and industry screenings or anything to sort of create the climate that would generate that kind of heat. In some ways, it's a nice contrast to the Sundance E5.
Uh-huh. I was, very taken and pretty thrilled by 71, which I saw in Berlin. Did you see that?
Yeah. I saw that in Berlin, I thought it was pretty remarkable, especially because it's a debut feature. And, it was interesting to me because the subtitle suggested that a lot of people were worried about, understanding what these characters are saying, but to me it was such a visual film, it didn't even really matter that much.
Well, I've been saying ever since the, I think probably the biggest standout for me was Paul Greengrass's Bloody Sunday. I said from the get-go that I wish that they could have subtitles. I don't see how it hurt to have subtitles. Some people were, but I really missed, I'm really struggling, and I swear to God I missed at least half of the dialogue, just because I can't get with the dialect. I just can't let it in. It doesn't come to me, and I just
right.
And of course they did have a subtitle option when it came out on DVD, so but it's rough with Irish dialects, it really is, but I didn't have that much of a problem because it's very visceral, and it's of course, and there's a lot of a lot of sort of two-faced intrigue and who's with who and that sort of thing. Pretty clever.
So did you see Start Up?
No, I didn't.
Also with Jack O'Connell, the same guy who's in 71, is coming out, I think, this month or next month.
I have not seen
Prison
that yet. Yeah.
Oh, man, it's great. And that's one where I think, the subtitles are kind of crucial because it is kind of dialogue-driven, but it's just, it's interesting because it starts out as this very brutal prison drama that transforms into a father-son bonding movie.
Okay.
They're both in prison together. And it's still very much about the way that they physically communicate. So,
right.
I talked to some distributors when we premiered at Telluride who were worried about the dialogue issue, but I still feel like, that's not the only thing going on. It's cinema, it's moving pictures, so,
Right.
I'm not sure how we got on this track, but it's an interesting thing to mull over.
Well, all right. So, apart from Buzzer, that being your personal favorite, what would be?
I can tell you my top five.
Okay.
The best narrative is I saw here, Buzzer. The other one is called Long Distance. The Spanish language title was 10,000 kilometers, and they had both here. So another first-time feature from a Spanish director.
Let's say it clearly. You're talking about the title of the film because you're coming in a little weakly, Eric. 10,000 km parenthesis long distance is the name of the film, according to what I'm reading, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because the English language title of the film is Long Distance. I think 10,000 kilometers is the Spanish language title, but they hadn't fully shifted it when it got to the festival.
Okay.
It's great. It's two actors. The first shot of the movie is, I think, 25 minutes long, and just involves them in their apartment figuring out that the woman in the relationship is going to go to L.A. for a residency, and they argue about it and decide to do it, even though they're trying to have a child. And the rest of the movie is their attempt to do this long-distance relationship through contemporary forms of communication, so Skype and text and Facebook and all these sorts of things become plot devices in terms of, you know, how do you maintain something that's actually an intimate relationship when technology creates this fragmented effect.
Right.
I thought it was really beautifully done.
Okay.
So that's one, you know, I don't know what kind of commercial prospects it has. Somebody really small to get out there, but it's one of the more confident debuts I've seen in a really long time.
Okay.
So that's worth checking out.
Right.
There's a movie called Faults that was here with Mary Elizabeth Winstead. It's kind of like the way that I was describing it to people was like Wes Anderson directing Marlene or something. This cult comedy about a guy.
Say the title one more time. I'm sorry.
Fault. It's called Fault.
Faults.
Faults.
Okay. Very good.
Yeah, that's the name of the cult in the movie, and it's basically about this author played by Leland Orser, who, you know, he was always just character actor, so it's really his first leading role, and he's hired to deprogram a woman played by Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who's been brainwashed.
Okay.
So again, it's kind of this two-hander, and they're in a hotel room for most of the movie, and there's a power dynamic going on where you're not sure if he's deprogramming her or she's deprogramming him, and it's also kind of bizarrely funny. So I was just really taken with it. It's a divisive one, though. It's very strange.
Okay.
You know, as you can imagine, at this festival, that's really the stuff that stands out the most. And there was another film about a long-distance relationship called The Heart Machine. It's a first-time feature from a guy named Zachary Wiegand, who's a freelance film critic in New York. And it stars John Gallagher Jr. from Short Term 12 and Caitlin Scheel, who's in all kinds of stuff these days. And in that one, it's about a guy who meets a woman online and thinks she lives in Berlin, and then slowly starts to realize that she's actually in the same city as him and has been lying to him. So it's this detective story where he starts to figure out what's going on and then investigate why she would be lying to him.
Huh.
So it's very interesting. It didn't get the kind of traction I thought it deserved. And I think it's partly because there was this other long-distance relationship movie that people paid a little bit more attention to. Also, it's a very strange movie. It's very sort of cryptic in its storytelling, and that kind of thing, you know, doesn't jump out at people in the same way that a, you know, very excessively emotional piece of storytelling would. So that was another one.
Is it just them talking on the phone? Is that mainly what it is?
No, I mean, it's really, it's a New York movie. I mean, John Gallagher Jr. spends a lot of the movie wandering around.
Okay.
Kind of picking up the pieces of who this person is. And so there's a lot of interesting moments where he's like, he'll pretend to seduce a woman who's a friend of the woman he has this relationship with and follow her up into her apartment and browse her laptop and things like that. So there's a lot of interesting moments where he's kind of snooping around. And it does have some legitimate suspense. Kind of a slow burn, so
I
think that threw some people off.
Okay.
I'm going to give you one more movie called The Infinite Man from Australia, which is a time travel comedy.
Say it one more time slowly so I can look it up.
Yeah, it's The Infinite Man.
The Infinite Man, okay, got it.
Yeah, and it's a movie about a guy who invents a time travel machine and keeps going back to the one-year anniversary of his relationship with his woman trying to fix it.
Yeah.
And it's got the Groundhog Day-esque element to it where he's basically reliving the same experience time and time again and keeps screwing it up. But it's very funny because he keeps going back and seeing other versions of himself and his girlfriend in the past and kind of sneaking around them. So it's almost like, Multiplicity or one of those kinds of movies where you just have the same person in all these different, parts of the scene. And the way it keeps building up, I thought was very clever and also economical because there's only three actors in the whole movie. So,
now you, the way you,
that's my top five. I'm looking at a list, and I figured I'd just give
you. You summarized at the end of your review that it's a under the radar entry. That's code for something, and that it should enjoy a solid life at genre festivals and could garner healthy returns in ancillary markets, if not much of a commercial release. What's the commercial release? What's the average person without the sophisticated taste buds of Eric Cohn? What would they like out of this thing?
Well, it's a very funny, sweet movie, but the challenge with the way that we review films is that there's a bit of a trade element in which, we analyze the marketplace potential for movies at festivals, and it always arrives at the end of the review, which is something we chose to do, because when you look at the Reporter and Variety, it's usually at the front of the review, and you feel it's better to kind of separate that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I've always felt that that's important, and one of the reasons why is what you just singled out, which is a lot of times just stuff that we like. But if you look at the reality of the marketplace, there's just no way that, a kind of quirky, Australian film with a kind of high concept premise that's difficult to describe to people and, doesn't have any major special effects, doesn't have any stars. It's not the kind of genre film that's going to play on 5,000 screens or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the truth. That being said, there is a huge market for genre films and ancillary markets, and I could see something like this, it winds up on the homepage of Hulu and it gets a couple strong reviews as it plays around.
Right.
It could have a kind of cult life online and on VOD and things like that. And for a movie like that, that's probably the best you could ask for. If you really think about it, because if somebody were just to dump it in a theater in New York or something like that on one screen, even if it got a solid capsule review in the New York Times, it's still not going to go that far.
Yeah.
So there is an element of optimism in saying that something has real potential in the ancillary market.
Okay. What about the Favreau? I take it you thought that was on the minor side.
Yeah, it's like Favreau calling up his famous friends to make his version of Swingers with a culinary hook.
Uh-huh.
I just found it to be kind of bland. Mm-hmm. It's not as terrible, I think, as some people had anticipated. It was certainly getting really bad buzz going into the festival, and Favreau, in his introduction, kind of seemed to be responding to some of that, because he said, he had no lofty aspirations with this movie, that this idea came to him after making larger films, just a kind of basic story, and that hadn't happened to him since he wrote the screenplay for Slingers. So, it's a kind of self-involved vanity project of sorts, and that's fine, I guess, for a director who can manage the time and resources. It goes on way longer than a little movie like this should. I mean, I was just sort of, I found a few funny moments early on, and then it just started to drag. So, I don't see a movie like that really going anywhere, but it doesn't really need to. It's open road, putting it out probably on a manageable scale, and it has some cheeky cameos from people like Robert Downey Jr., who they could probably cut into a trailer to draw some extra people.
Yeah.
And it's definitely not an ambitious movie. I mean, it's just Favreau playing this chef who gets fired after a bad review, and then tries to kind of rejuvenate his career with a food truck and bonds with his son. And I don't know.
It's funny, when a filmmaker will come up and deliver an opening remark or two before the film begins in front of a festival audience, it's remarkable to me how frequently, I would almost go to say almost every time, they seem to, if there's something a little maybe lacking or not quite together about the film, they'll always allude to it. They'll always say something, I hope you like it.
Right.
Stay with it, or, I like it and hope you do too. Or, there's always a little hint,
Always that same formula. And I always find that to be kind of, antithetical to what the movie going process should be. You know, it's like, let us see it first and then we can talk about it, mm-hmm. or not.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just the whole introductory process is sort of kind of defeats the point of how people watch movies. You know, I mean, I'm not going to spend the whole time thinking about what Favreau said when I'm watching the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
You know, there's about.
Funny to me because he also acknowledged Harry Knowles in the audience, and I was just thinking about, you know, how that environment for certain kinds of movies is just mm-hmm. just works. I mean, Chef could have gone over a lot worse if it premiered at Sundance or something like that.
Yeah.
But South by Southwest is the opening night film. There was an audience and a community of people who were just ready to embrace it.
Yep.
And in the Paramount Theater, the acoustics are really strong. So, you know, I didn't see Neighbors, but I understand it was a similar kind of thing. You know, every laugh got magnified 100 times.
Right.
And that just really helps for a movie like that.
You know, when you look at what we have coming out overall this year, I did a sort of a count of what looks pretty good. Obviously, I don't know, but it looks pretty good. I'd say well over 50 films there are. Really looking pretty interesting, and they're all theatrical, and they're all looking to, you know, do the whole thing. It was mentioned to me yesterday during a chat with Sasha that she was saying that it's just getting more and more to the point that that theatrical is being more and more given up to the dumb CG blockbusters, and that the stuff that you and I like is going to be increasingly more small screen, more VOD, more marginal, you know, film festivals, of course, and But not as much of a theatrical, and it's going to be smaller and smaller pieces of the pie, and that the amusement park, you know, cheap amusement aspect of cinema is going to be pretty much the whole, more and more of the game, eating up more and more of it. Do you see that evolving, or is she wrong, essentially, in her analysis of what's going to
happen? The challenge with all of us is that we live in this bubble where we watch movies for free, so we're kind of out of touch, I think, to some degree with the way that let's say the masses, whatever that means, consume moving images.
Yeah.
And, you know, it does seem to me like more and more people just watch stuff at home to the extent where that's the place where you have to get them.
Mm.
You know, but I think that there is like a kind of alternative film culture in which, you know, watching movies in theaters isn't just about seeing the big tent poles. It's also not really about, you know, like first-run features. It's more about spaces where events take place. I mean, in New York, micro cinema culture is really booming. I mean, there are places like Videology in Williamsburg that also has a bar and does trivia nights and things like that and special events. And that, to me, seems like the best kind of haven for, you know, smaller movies to play in public spaces. But obviously, there's much more money to be made for these kinds of movies on VOD. I mean, it's just, it's so obvious to me when you think about how people discover stuff by, you know, checking out what's on Netflix or just opening up iTunes or even YouTube. I mean, it's just, there's this arbitrary nature to the way that people process media that I think is really defining the marketplace. And the more people who capitalize on that, the more this alternate marketplace starts to turn into a real model. So, you know, we're approaching about a decade since VOD as a real kind of idea for releasing a movie, and especially day and date, was invented with Magnolia doing Steven Soderbergh's Bubble, as you'll recall, I assume, on day and date, when they released in theaters and on VOD at the same time. And so I think it makes sense that it would take about 10 years for something like that to become a real marketplace as opposed to an experiment.
Yeah.
And that seems to be where we are right now. I mean, the people who are running around a place like South by Southwest and looking for movies, you know, it's not Michael Barker and Tom Bernard at Sony Pictures Classics, you know what I mean? Like, they're getting the new Woody Allen movies, the new Almodovar movies, things like that, like these sort of tentpoles of the art house world.
Mm-hmm.
And those movies kind of sell themselves to some degree. I mean, it's an older movie-going audience. It's going to go to those movies because there's a prestige element already in play for them. But for these smaller kind of, you know, discoveries, you know, there isn't really like a specific model for how something like that can break out. Unless, you know, Paramount wants to buy it and spend $100 million on marketing it, it just doesn't seem likely that you're going to be able to get much traction with, you know, mainstream moviegoers who spend top dollar on tickets.
Yeah.
So that's why we're seeing this, like, bigger and bigger gulf between the blockbuster market. marketplace in the indies. But the indies, I think, have a leg up, because if you think about it, if you can make money with some kind of distribution deal that's mainly capitalizing on VOD audiences, you know, that gives you more autonomy. You know, whereas when you release a movie on a larger scale, I mean, there's just so many different kinds of things you have to take into account, from, you know, the marketing budget to the kind of promotional tour and things like that. And you can lose a lot of money and a lot of time doing those sorts of things. So it just makes more sense that there would be sort of like a DIY sensibility informing how these movies get out there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was quite the expansive, all-encompassing answer of where it is. All right. Well, this has been so. There's nothing. What about the lower? About how about Veronica Mars? Did you see that, or do you have any?
You know, I've never seen an episode of the show, so we assigned that to somebody else. I heard it was fine. If you like it, then if you like the show, the movie will be satisfying.
Yeah.
That it's kind of like three episodes strung together.
Mm-hmm.
So the story behind it is very interesting. How the kind of the fan demand is why the whole thing happened with the Kickstarter campaign and all that.
Right.
I'm sure it played well, but honestly, I could care less.
Yeah,
you know, it's
right.
Just not my kind of thing.
Sure.
I mean, I was a little shocked by the movie that won the Grand Jury Prize. There's a conversation to be had about that.
Tell us about that one. It was called again. What?
It's called Fort Tilden, which
Fort
is the name
right.
of a beach and campground in Brooklyn.
Okay.
And it's kind of like a proto girls kind of a thing with these two overprivileged white chicks who. Spend the day trying to get from one part of Brooklyn to another part of Brooklyn to meet up with some guys they want to sleep with and score some drugs along the way.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny in parts. It's very all over the place. For every laugh that lands, there's a lot more that I just found really grating. And I guess, you know, for the most part, they're aiming for satire, so you don't want to take these characters too seriously. But then at the same time, I felt like there were parts of it where the movie was as kind of superficial and crass as the characters they were writing. Like
yeah.
there are these moments where they try to spoof not only the people at the center of the movie, but their relationship to kind of the melting pot in New York, the foreign taxi drivers, the Latinos at the corner store and things like that. And those characters were written so broadly that it was almost like there was like a touch of racism to it. And so I just felt it was a very uneven movie, and I was surprised that the jury, which was headed by Oliver Platt, would go for something like that when there were other movies in competition that I felt much stronger. So you never know. I mean, it's a totally arbitrary process, and I'd be curious to know what you and others think about this movie when it gets out there, if it does get out there. But
yeah.
To me, it was not, you know, like this is the next movie at Dunham or something.
Right. What are you looking for, and we'll wrap it up, what are you looking forward to seeing that has already got a release that's coming out either this month or April before the Cannes season begins? What are you looking for? What's got you going in particular? Anything that you haven't seen yet? Have you seen Noah? You haven't seen Noah yet, I take it, right?
I have not seen Noah. I was shocked by the Mexican junketeers who went down there and were, you know, kind of holding back their reactions, because it just seemed to me like, you know, this was a movie that needed a more kind of analytical view before it got out there. You know, like, I assume that there are people who are going to defend this movie, and I would like to read those defenses.
Well, isn't that the understanding when you are brought down? You're understood to be in the camp of the filmmaker.
Right.
You basically
right.
Are got his or her back. And you're not going to be merciless when it comes to your reaction. You're going to, you know, you're going to be more considered and all.
I get that strategy for certain kinds of movies. It didn't seem like the kind of movie where that strategy makes a lot of sense. I mean, it seemed like the kind of thing where you want to find one amazing advocate for this movie,
right,
who can really lead the charge in a better way.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Noah to me doesn't sound like a fanboy kind of a movie. It sounds to me like something that you know, deals with history and mythology in a very interesting
mm-hmm.
way. It's going to need that kind of an intellectual reading
right.
in order for, you know, it to be sort of validated.
Mm.
I don't imagine that people going for a fun spectacle are going to be satisfied. So
yeah.
It's very strange to me that they would do this Mexico City premiere as sort of like the way that they release Noah into the world. But,
yeah.
You know, I'm sure the story is much deeper than what we've seen on the surface.
From what I understand, understand, they're not going to show it, at least to a lot of us, until 2 days before it opens on the 26th. Although there is, I believe, a broadcast-only junket. I'm not even sure if it's this coming weekend or the following weekend. I would imagine maybe this coming weekend. They won't tell me.
Yeah. I'm not super excited. I'm looking forward to it. It's got to have something interesting going on. I've never been bored to tears by an Aronofsky film. And I thought The Fountain was an interesting failure. And if even if this is in that league, I'm much more interested in something that's sort of the product of, you know, an artist fighting the system than just sort of, you know, letting it do as it pleases. So, mm-hmm. you know, even if there's, you know, 10, 15 minutes that I really love outside of, you know, the rest not working, I think, you know, there's something worth talking about there. So that's what I'm kind of hoping for, is that at least there's a little bit of sort of like pure Aronofsky that slipped through whatever was going on behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, you know, the thing that I'm really looking forward to, because I only saw the first half, is Nymphomaniac. Because
uh-huh.
I saw the volume one at Sundance, and they did a secret screening for it.
Yeah.
But I you know, I got the sense that this was really one movie. So I'm going to see it in the second half in New York next week and finally kind of like complete that equation.
Well, I was, I'll just share with you that I thought that when part two began, I thought, wow, the game has been stepped up a lot, and I'm starting to really like this a lot more. I didn't dislike part one, but I found it obviously very bright and very and intentionally trying to be amusing and yet very dark
and
you know, obsessive at the same time. Interesting. Not a dumb film at all. Good film. I mean, he's never not going to make an unintelligent film, but I just didn't think it was. I didn't think it was as interesting or fulfilling as others of his that I've been absolutely devoted to. But
you can't really control von Trier, and it seems to me like there was some attempt to do that by dividing this movie into two,
uh-huh.
and I don't know, I just feel like you know, that behind the scenes negotiation must have impacted the movie somehow.
Yeah.
You know, like the very resistance to the links and the indulgences may have spurred him on to make it even crazier. Because I got the sense just from volume one that this was like he was trying to basically consolidate everything he's done up until this point into one magnum opus. Mm. The movie's all over the place. I was really surprised by how funny it was, the first chapters, and all of a sudden it turns into the kingdom or something, you know, with that very bleak hospital sequence. So, I mean, I haven't seen the second half, so I'm really curious to see how that tone shifts again, but it just seemed like, you know, he was trying to make many different movies at once.
Yeah. Okay, on that note, man, thank you very much for taking the time. It's really been nice hearing. I'm going to, you know, I've got three, four interesting films on my list, so thanks for sharing.
Pleasure. I mean, look, think this festival is a lot more valuable than people realize because, like we've been talking about, it's such a dense, difficult marketplace for smaller films.
Yeah.
And if you go out here, the environment makes it just much more interesting to find them because you don't have to fight to prioritize things. I mean, if you're at Sundance or Cannes, you know you're going to go for the big movies, and then other stuff kind of falls to the wayside, and maybe you'll never get a chance to see it again. So, you know, that's why I think not just, you know, going to this festival is valuable, but just, like, paying attention to what movies come out of it.
Sure.
Because, you know, they're only going to get this kind of showcase once.
Right, exactly, yeah. All right, man. Thank you very much for your time, and we'll see you again.
My pleasure.
You'll be in Cannes, I take it?
I'll see you there.
Okay.
Going back and forth on the quad like everybody else.
Okay. Take care, man.
All right. See ya.
Bye.